Ruth in chapter 4, starting to read at verse 1. What's in my Bible might be very slightly different from what's in the Pew Bible. It's just that my new Bible has fallen apart, and so I've had to revert back to my old one again. Ruth chapter 4, starting to read at verse 1. Meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat there. When a kinsman redeemer he had mentioned came along, Boaz said, "Come over here, my friend, and sit down." So he went over and sat down. Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and said, "Sit here." And they did so. Then he said to the kinsman redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our brother Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of the seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me, so I will know. For no one has the right to do it except you, and I am next in line." "I will redeem it," he said. Then Boaz said, "On the day you buy the land from Naomi and from Ruth the Moabitess, you acquire the dead man's widow in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property." At this, the kinsman redeemer said, "Then I cannot redeem it, because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it." Now, in earlier times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was the method of legalizing transactions in Israel. So the kinsman redeemer said to Boaz, "Buy it yourself." And he removed his sandal. Then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, "Today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion and Mahlon. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from the town records. Today you are witnesses." Then the elders and all those at the gate said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah." So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. Then he went to her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The woman said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." Then Naomi took the child, laid him in her lap, and cared for him. The woman living there said, "Naomi has a son." And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. This then is the family line of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron, Hezron the father of Ram, Ram the father of Abinadab, Abinadab the father of Nashon, Nashon the father of Salmon, Salmon the father of Boaz, Boaz the father of Obed, Obed the father of Jesse, and Jesse the father of David.
Well, I finally admitted defeat. This year, it started one fateful October Sunday afternoon. Jade and I were round her parents' house, and there I was, minding my own business, when Jade and her mum started watching Home Alone in October. This shouldn't be allowed. Although it's not as bad as when we lived up north. I came home from work early, I think it was in October, and there was this suspiciously sparkly reindeer on the windowsill. Christmas decorations shouldn't be allowed until December. I don't know what you make of Halloween, but it has at least one use. It keeps most of the decorations out of the shops until November. We've got a different method at home, though. See, all the Christmas decorations are stored up in the loft, and Jade can't go there because she might get eaten by spiders. Now, I've never actually seen any spiders in the loft, but I'm happy to go along with it if it means I can wait until the 1st of December to get them out. Which I guess means that's what I'm going to be doing this afternoon before the prayer service. But I have to admit, it's finally Christmas. The waiting's over. Jade can have her decorations. Although, is it really Christmas? It's really Advent, isn't it? It's the first Sunday of Advent, which is supposed to be a time of waiting. You know, children waiting to see what Father Christmas might bring. Families waiting to see the distant relatives at Christmas. Maybe over-optimistic Brits waiting to see if it will finally be a white Christmas. It won't. Maybe I'll leave the decorations in the loft until Christmas Eve for a more authentic Advent experience. Jade's raising her eyebrows. We don't really like waiting, do we? I ordered a couple of things from Amazon's Black Friday sale, and it's really annoying. I have to wait 2 whole days for them to arrive. It's just not on. Maybe then we need Advent. Maybe we need a whole month of waiting to train us to wait better. Because really, the whole Christian life is about waiting for Christ, our Redeemer, to return. Well, today we're looking at Ruth chapter 4, which is a story of waiting and fulfillment. Do you feel like you're always waiting? Have you ever been on one of those hikes where you make it over a hill only to see there's a whole other one between you and your destination? I think Ruth might have felt a bit like that. And sometimes we do, don't we? We're waiting for heaven, but it's not coming very quickly. But just as Christmas Day will arrive in 24 sleeps time, what we're waiting for will arrive. Ruth 4 shows us that even when it looks impossible, Jesus redeems us at great personal cost. The Spirit renews us through new birth, and the Father adopts us into his family, whose name will be remembered forever. So what have we seen in Ruth so far? Well, I think it's kind of like a Netflix box set. Like any good TV series, there's always a twist at the end of each episode. In episode 1, things go from bad to worse. Naomi goes from bereavement to bitterness. Her husband dies. Her 2 sons die. Things don't really get much worse, do they? She returns home to Israel from Moab with nothing, convinced that God has it in for her. But then there's a little green shoot of hope in the last sentence as the harvest was beginning. And then in episode 2, Naomi moves from bitterness to blessing as Boaz demonstrates the loving kindness of God by providing for Ruth. But in the last sentence, we're reminded that Ruth is still a single widow in a foreign country with only an elderly mother-in-law to look after her. So in episode 3, Naomi hatches a plan to get Ruth married off. But then it all goes a bit wrong. Do you ever feel like your life is like that? Every time things are looking up, something goes wrong. Well, this story has something to say to you. See, Ruth asked Boaz to be her guardian redeemer in chapter 3, verse 9. What's one of those, you're wondering? Well, in Mark's Bible, it was kinsman redeemer. But Leviticus chapter 25 tells us the answer. It says, if one of your fellow Israelites becomes poor and sells some of their property, their nearest relative is to come and redeem what they've sold. Basically, it was the welfare state for ancient Israel, providing a way that rich Israelites were obliged to provide for poor ones and without a computer system in sight. Boaz was willing to do all this, but there was a problem. He says, although it's true that I am a guardian redeemer of our family, there's another who's more closely related than I. Like buses, Ruth had been waiting for a redeemer all this time, and now 2 come along at once. But by now, Ruth's fallen in love with Boaz. It's like she was going hiking. She'd got over one peak, only to discover there's a whole other hill between her and her destination. How often do our lives feel like that? Nothing ever goes right the first time. Imagine how Ruth must be feeling. But because Boaz was one of those annoying proper people, he was determined to do the right thing. He said, wait till tomorrow to see if this other man will be the redeemer. I don't imagine Ruth got much sleep that night. So then, how would it be settled? Who would redeem Ruth? Well, our chapter starts, doesn't it, saying, meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat down there just as the guardian redeemer he had mentioned came along. Ruth's full of fantastic little coincidences. It's almost like the narrator's hinting that there's someone at work behind the scenes arranging everything. Boaz has got everyone he needs together. In those days, these kind of matters weren't decided in a courtroom full of highly paid lawyers, because they didn't have any of those. They were decided in public, with the most respected men in the town as witnesses. So we have Boaz, the nameless would-be redeemer, and the town elders. The stage is set. But it's not just a business transaction for Boaz. He loves Ruth and is desperate to marry her. But how can he? The other man has a stronger claim. How would Boaz play it? How would he persuade this nameless would-be redeemer to give up his claim to redeem the land and marry Ruth? Well, with some clever legal arguments. He decides to split the two issues up, starting with the field. Verse 3. Then he said to the guardian redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you'll redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me, so I'll know. For no one has the right to do it except you, and I'm next in line. Do you notice Boaz doesn't mention Ruth at all? He presents a very attractive proposition of a bit of land Naomi owns. You see, back then there wouldn't have been fields separated by pretty little hedgerows with robins singing or whatever they do. This would have been part of a common field that belonged to Naomi. But she couldn't farm it, and now the harvest was over, she couldn't rely on living off Boaz's generosity either. She needed cash, so she had to sell it. And under the rules in ancient Israel, it had to be offered first to the guardian redeemer of the family. Well, obviously he'd want to buy it. It's a no-brainer. I will redeem it, he said at the end of verse 4. Of course he does. But he's fallen straight into Boaz's trap. See, now Boaz brings up another ancient Israelite law. Because preserving the family name was very important. One of the greatest tragedies was for a man to die childless, as happened in Naomi's family in chapter 1. If a husband died and his widow had no children, she was to marry the brother of her late husband to continue the family name. Deuteronomy 25, verse 5 and 6 explains, if brothers are living together and one of them dies without a son, his widow must not marry outside the family. Her husband's brother shall take her and marry her and fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to her. The first son she bears shall carry on the name of the dead brother, so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. That's what the Sadducees were referring to when they said, Teacher, Moses told us that if a man dies without having children, his brother must marry the widow and raise up offspring for him. Boaz cleverly combines these two laws in verse 5. And Boaz said, On the day you buy the land from Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the dead man's widow, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. Well, that did the trick, didn't it? Boaz is saying, you can't act like a redeemer under one law and not under another. There's no picking and choosing of laws here. So then the nameless would-be redeemer says, well, then I cannot redeem it because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it. Well, what changed his mind? Surely the deal just got even better. Kind of buy one, get one free offer. Well, no. Because the land on its own would make him richer. He could combine it into his own land and get some more money. And a wife on her own would probably be a good thing. He kind of implied that he's a widower here. But the land and a wife meant he would have to farm this land using his own resources, only for it to go to Ruth's child when he dies. His existing children would then be worse off. This is a bad deal. The worst deal in the history of trade deals, maybe ever. Verse 8. So the guardian redeemer said to Boaz, buy it yourself. And he removed his sandal. And it worked. Phew. Crisis averted. Our happy couple can get married after all. Well, that's all very well. But why on earth is this in our Bibles? To show us the value of clever legal arguments, or that we'll always get to marry the one we want in the end? No, I don't think so. See, Boaz is the model redeemer. The book of Leviticus talks a lot about the responsibilities of a redeemer to help the helpless by bearing the costs in their place, buying back land, buying back relatives out of slavery. Leviticus mentions the word redeemer 22 times, the precise number of times the book of Ruth uses it. Ruth is like this cleverly constructed portrait of what it looks like to actually live out the law of Leviticus. It's as if our author knew that everyone always skips over Leviticus when they get to it in their Bible reading plans. He knows that different people prefer different styles of books. Some, like me, like to see a set of logical rules set out in black and white. But others like stories that illustrate those principles. The Bible has something for everyone. So if you want to know how to live out God's law, look at Boaz. But there's more to it than that. One scholar points out that before Leviticus 25, the work of a redeemer is only associated with God. Jacob was redeemed from evil. God redeemed his people from slavery in Egypt. And Moses sang of God's love for those he'd redeemed. When people act as redeemers for their family, they imitate the work of God to the poor and the helpless. Boaz is a picture then of what God does for his people. He demonstrates the redeeming love God has shown him in his redeeming love for Ruth. But more than merely imitating the redeeming love of God, Boaz is like a tool in the great Redeemer's hands. Because one way God redeems us from our everyday problems is through other people. Leviticus basically says, because God has redeemed you when you were weak and helpless, you now redeem the weak and helpless. So we must care for the poor and the vulnerable, the refugee and the widow, as Boaz cared for Ruth. Even if it costs us, even if it might endanger our inheritance. We've been redeemed, so we must redeem others. The nameless would-be redeemer here comes across badly. God had redeemed him and his people, but he doesn't want to redeem a poor widowed refugee because it might cost him a bit of money. Don't be like the nameless would-be redeemer. Be like Boaz. Imitate him as he imitates the great redeeming God. But more than a picture pointing back to what God did at the Exodus, and more than a picture of how we should behave today, Boaz is a picture who points forwards to the great Redeemer, who redeems us from our ultimate problem. Like I said last week at Messy Church, stories in the Old Testament are like the chocolates in the Advent calendar you started this morning. Maybe you did, maybe you didn't. There was cheese in our one. Did you know even our cat's got an Advent calendar? Anyway, in an Advent calendar, each chocolate is good in its own right. It's a lovely little present. But really, it exists to point you forwards to the greater present that's coming on Christmas Day. Each story in the Old Testament is good in its own right, but it exists to point us to Jesus. And this one more clearly than most. Because Boaz was a worthy redeemer, but Jesus is the greater redeemer. Titus chapter 2 talks about the glory of our great God and Saviour Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us to redeem us from all wickedness. Jesus was born into our family at that first Christmas, specifically to redeem us. Galatians 4 verse 4 says, God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those under the law, that we might receive adoption to sonship. We'll come on to that later. Like Boaz, Jesus was from the tribe of Judah. Like Boaz, Jesus lived a life full of acts of kindness, providing for the poor and needy. Like Boaz, Jesus was from Bethlehem. Like Boaz, Jesus didn't merely keep the law, but he went over the top to keep the spirit of the law. Like Boaz, Jesus paid to buy us back, to release us from debt, to return our inheritance as the children of God. Like Boaz, Jesus brings the foreigner back to the promised land, to promised rest, and gives us a name that will last forever. But whereas Boaz paid with a few coins to redeem one person, Jesus paid with his life to redeem a whole multitude. Boaz is a great redeemer, but he points us to the greater redeemer. Someone said this book is the story of a redeemer from Bethlehem in Judah who fulfilled and exceeded the law with his acts of mercy and abundant provision before entering into a covenant with a bride from the nations. This is the story of Jesus. So let's press on and see what other jewels God has for us. What else can this story teach us about God's redemption plan? Naomi isn't just redeemed, but renewed. Because Boaz didn't just redeem the land, did he? He married Ruth. He started a new relationship. And everyone watching knew something new was starting, didn't they? Verse 11. Then the elders and all the people at the gate said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the family of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah." They pray for God to knit this foreign woman from a country that was usually at war with Israel into the fabric of Israel's history. She would be as big a part of Israel's story as the famous woman from Genesis. It's amazing. But that's what Jesus does for us, isn't it? He doesn't only redeem us, he marries us. He brings us into the family. Once we were enemies of God, as alienated from him as Moab was from Israel, at open warfare with one another. But God, in his great love, sent Jesus to make peace, to marry us, to bring us back into the family, to bring us home for Christmas dinner. Now, far from being enemies, we carry the family name. Jesus redeems us and the Father adopts us. See, Ruth could have joined the family as the slightly embarrassing aunt no one likes to admit being related to, but you kind of have to invite along for Boxing Day. But no, they want her to be front and centre of the family. We're as much part of the family as those old names on the family tree. We're as much part of the family of God as Rachel and Leah, as Jacob and Judah. All because of Jesus, our Redeemer, our husband. It's not just that God has brought us back out of slavery at great cost to himself. God has started a new relationship with us. Collectively, we've been married to our Redeemer, as Ruth was married to Boaz. Everything that's his is ours. His land, his home, his family. And everything that's ours is his. Our poverty, our neediness, our sinfulness. What's ours is his, and what's his is ours. What a great deal. Even the nameless would-be redeemer wouldn't turn that deal down. And Jesus has made a solemn promise to love us forever. Our redemption is permanent. We have a new relationship with our Redeemer. We're part of the family forever. Although maybe you're not part of the family yet, but you're wishing you could be. Well, what are you waiting for? Jesus came to earth for this very purpose. That's what Christmas is all about. You might think that you're not good enough, but Jesus gave himself for us to redeem us from all wickedness. Jesus died to redeem you. Whatever you've done, even if you've spent your life fighting against God as Moab fought against Israel, Jesus wants to redeem you. He loves you. He wants that relationship with you. He wants to bring you into the family. There's an empty space at the Christmas table with your name right on it. Don't turn down his offer of redemption, of a new relationship. So we're not just redeemed, but renewed. All the elders and all the people at the gates were praying for children from this marriage. And God answered their prayer. In verse 13, so Boaz took Ruth and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive and she gave birth to a son. The perfect happy ending to the perfect Christmas fairy tale. But it's more than that. Verse 14, the women said to Naomi, praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. That might just be a normal way for Christians to express their thankfulness, but we shouldn't overlook the point the author's making here. He doesn't beat us over the head with what God's doing. It's all very subtle. A few coincidences here, a few shouts of praise there. But behind all the ordinary actions of ordinary people doing ordinary things, an extraordinary God is bringing about his extraordinary purposes. See, Ruth didn't just get pregnant, did she? The Lord enabled her to conceive. Boaz didn't just redeem Ruth, and therefore Naomi. No, the Lord has not left you without a guardian redeemer. God is at work in the details of your everyday life. Nothing is too small or too insignificant for him. No one is too small or too insignificant for him. Maybe you think your life's governed by random chance, but it's not. God orders every detail according to what's best for you. Look at what this little baby does for Naomi. What a turnaround. From that barren bitterness in chapter 1 to a gushing granny in chapter 4. Once Naomi was saying to Ruth and Orpah that she was so old she might as well be dead. And it was all God's fault. Now her friends see the cute baby and say he will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. Through this new birth, she has new life. She'll be sustained forever. She's been renewed. And isn't that what God has done for us? See, once we were dead in our sins. Spiritually, there was no difference between us and a corpse in the ground. And maybe we knew this, And we were convinced it was because God was against us. Maybe we were consumed with bitterness as Naomi was. But he wasn't against us any more than he was against Naomi. The Holy Spirit brought about new life in us. Not by the birth of a baby, but by us being born again. And he renews our life and sustains us even in our old age. When it seems that God has abandoned us, when it seems our life is going from bad to worse, when we climb over one hill only to find another one in the way, we can remember we haven't been abandoned. Jesus redeems us. The Father adopts us through our marriage to his Son. And the Spirit gives us new life through new birth. Chapter 4 is a beautiful picture of our redemption, of our rebirth, of our renewal. But it doesn't end there, does it? There's this little postscript at the end. And it's not like a Harry Potter postscript. I don't know if you remember the end of the last Harry Potter. There's this weirdly unnecessary scene where the children of the main characters, who weirdly all happen to be the same age, all get the train to school. What was the point of that? Why not just say they all lived happily ever after and let's get on with our lives? Who cares about these children? In fact, you only remember them because of who their parents were. You can see that in the ridiculous names they're given. Well, that's the exact opposite of what happens here. Verse 17, the women living there said, Naomi has a son. And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. This then is the family line of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Amminadab. Amminadab, the father of Nahshon. Nahshon, the father of Salmon. Salmon, the father of Boaz. Boaz, the father of Obed. Obed, the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of David. This isn't some boring postscript. When we looked at chapter 1, I said that you could imagine a movie with an opening scene tracking over Naomi's first 10 years of life, with everyone dying and Naomi standing at the graveside, getting more and more hunched over and more wrinkles on her brow. 10 years pass, and it's all disaster. Well, then maybe this is the closing credits. People standing by the cradle, beaming with joy as 10 generations of babies are born, reversing the 10 years of death at the beginning. But it's more than just a poetic closing credit sequence. This is the whole point of the book. This isn't like that scene in Harry Potter where you only remember the children because of who their parents are. Here, we only remember the parents because of who their children are. And particularly one child. The book ends emphatically with the name David. It's the story of God working quietly behind the scenes as ordinary people do ordinary things in order to bring about his extraordinary purposes through one extraordinary person, King David. Do you remember the people at the gate prayed about Boaz? May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. And the woman prayed about little baby Obed. May he become famous throughout Israel. Well, their prayer was answered, wasn't it? Bethlehem, a tiny little town that had no business being famous, did indeed become famous throughout Israel as the birthplace of King David. But it doesn't stop there. This postscript is like a big sign pointing to another famous name from Bethlehem. It was to Bethlehem that Samuel the prophet came to anoint the great-grandson of Boaz and Ruth to be king over Israel. But it was also to Bethlehem that Micah prophesied, "But to you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from old, from ancient times." And so it was to Bethlehem that Joseph came with Mary on a donkey under the decree of Caesar Augustus to be registered. And it was in Bethlehem that the Saviour of the world was born. The whole point of this book is to point us to David, who points us to Jesus, the great Redeemer King. The whole of the Old Testament is like a great neon arrow pointing to Jesus. It's all about him. Like our Advent calendars point us to Christmas Day, one chocolate at a time. The Old Testament points us to Jesus, one story at a time. Boaz wasn't only famous in Bethlehem. Boaz made Bethlehem famous throughout the world. We're even talking about him in Crocken Hill this morning. God gave Boaz a name that lasts forever. Do you see how God answered the prayers of ordinary men and women? Do you see how God used their normal, faithful lives? Because we might never be famous in our own right. That's okay. Seems like nowadays everyone wants to be famous, from YouTube stars to Instagram influencers. I was reading a story the other week about some outrage at Facebook hiding the number of likes an Instagram post has. Apparently some people's whole business model will break if they can't prove how famous they are. And at the moment, you can see on TV in an evening some alleged celebrities living in a jungle in Australia eating insects in a desperate bid to preserve their fame. Everyone wants to be famous, don't they? It's not a new instinct. Do you remember this nameless would-be redeemer? He's so desperate to preserve his inheritance, that is, to keep the family name going. He wanted a name that lasted beyond his lifetime, a name that lasts forever. And he thought that helping the helpless refugee Ruth would damage his inheritance, his name, his family's fame. But how ironic. The opposite turned out to be true. His name isn't even recorded. Our passage goes to quite a lot of effort not to name him. But Ruth's name takes pride of place forever in the family tree of the Messiah. Matthew chapter 1 says, "This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham." And then it goes on to say, "Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz, the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David." Look at Ruth there, amongst some of the most famous names in history. Attempts to make ourselves a name that lasts forever will always fail. Babel shows us that. Our nameless would-be redeemer shows us that. But through Jesus, our greater redeemer, our greater Boaz, we're given a family name that will last forever. We're part of the family of God, and his name will never fail. So, why have I called this sermon Awaiting the Redeemer, when we've already been redeemed, renewed, and given the name that we remembered forever? After all, Ruth was only really waiting for a few verses. Well, yes, we have been redeemed. But in an important way, we're still waiting to be redeemed from this world of tears. The book of Ruth was probably written during the exile about events that took place a long time ago. That's why our narrator explains the custom with the sandal that happened in earlier times in Israel in verse 7. So what was the point of writing this book? Well, maybe you're like those Israelites in exile. Maybe everything keeps going wrong. Even when it looks like it's going right, it goes wrong. You get over one hill just to notice another in your way. You solve one problem just to come across another. But don't worry. You might be in trouble. But wait. The Redeemer is coming, just as he came before. The Holy Spirit has the same message for us as he had for the original readers, sitting in exile, wondering if things could ever get better. God's already redeemed his people once. Wait for the Redeemer to come again. The exiles were waiting for the greater King David, the one Micah said would be the ruler over Israel. Well, we know his name is Jesus, but we're still waiting, aren't we? Sometimes it feels like everything's going wrong. Sometimes it feels like one setback after another. But wait. He is coming as he came before. We've been redeemed, we've been renewed, we'll be remembered. So we wait for the Redeemer to come. That's what Advent's about. The redeemed wait to be fully redeemed. The renewed wait to be fully renewed. The ones who remembered wait to be remembered forever. And while we wait, we sing, because we know our hope is secure. We're going to sing a lovely Advent hymn, which fits the story of Ruth beautifully.